This is Dave Herman. Welcome to this very special WNEW-FM broadcast of our conversation with George Harrison. It's been almost 30 years since the Beatles first started playing together in Liverpool. It's 20 years since the release of Sgt. Pepper, and about 17 years since the Beatles disbanded and George Harrison released his first solo album, All Things Must Pass. And it's been almost 5 years since George has made any records at all. And for just as long has remained, for the most part, away from the rock and roll spotlight. So when we found out that he was coming to the States to deliver his new record, Cloud Nine, to his record company in Los Angeles, we asked him if we could come out and spend some time talking with him for our WNEW-FM listeners. He agreed, and we were quite flattered that this was the only individual radio station in America that he would have time to visit with during his very short stay. We sat down at about noon on a sunny California day just a few weeks ago and began our conversation by asking George some of the reasons why it has taken him so long since his last recording.
I think a number of things. I just got a little tired of making records by myself, because basically most of the records I made since the production with Phil Spector on All Things Must Pass, with the exception of one album that had no title, I was co-produced with Russ Titelman, but all the rest I tended to write the songs, arrange them myself, produce them, perform them and mix them, and I found I was getting a bit bogged down by the end of it. I was just really tired of that, plus the fact that in the recession, that period when the oil crisis was on, all the businesses were going down the tubes and panicking, and I think that affected the radio and record businesses too. And there was a slump, particularly in the attitude of people, and I found it was a bit difficult. It was like beating your head on a brick wall in order to get your songs on the radio. Granted, I'm not the greatest person for doing promotion, but nevertheless, you know, when you make a record, spend that much time, you know, you expect it to go on the radio in some form. And I actually wrote a song pertaining to that, which is called Blood from a Clone. Because at that time, they just wanted everybody to sound just the same. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to have a rest because I'm not really enjoying it at this particular time. So, as you know, because we worked together on Monty Python's Life of Brian movie, that you know that I've got this film company, and we've been doing plenty of films. And there's been lots of things happening, really. I don't feel like I've stopped work, particularly. I've continued to write and record songs throughout the years between Troppo and Cloud Nine.
So are the songs on Cloud Nine all brand new ones by that within the last year, let's say, or while you were in production for the album, or a few laying around from years ago?
Two songs from the winter of 83, 84, and that is Cloud Nine itself, and Just for Today.
So you got a real all-star lineup on the band,
well,
on the album.
Fortunately, all my friends happen to be stars. You know, it's not that I chose stars, it's just that, like, when I hear a particular guitar solo, like, for instance, Devil's Radio, I think, that's Eric. That's his style. And so, you know, he just happens to be a friend, and the same with Ringo. You know, I hear a particular drum sound that I want on many of the tracks,
and Elton.
Ringo. Elton was calling me when he was in Australia on the tour with the Melbourne Symphony, because Ray Cooper, who's in Elton's band, actually is working for Handmade Films, has done for the last 8 or 9 years. So they call me periodically, and Elton was saying, oh, it's great, I hear you're going to make a new album. If you want me to play on it, just give me a call.
It seems like in the last year or so, a lot of, you know, the really great rock and roll people from the beginning.
You're so polite.
Well, listen, I'm a radio rock and roll old timer. So. No, really, I was thinking that, you know, Steve Winwood came up with a new album and a big success.
Eric Clapton's success is probably
bigger
now than even the days with Cream. And the Grateful Dead, we're talking about American Rock. Bob Dylan is back on top of it. Did that, all of this happening with people who are your contemporaries, have any?
No, I wasn't.
Did
really
it in any way say maybe it's time? No. Maybe they want to hear from George again.
No, it wasn't a conscious thing like that. It may have the similar reason because it just felt to me, not particularly this year, but maybe a year or 18 months ago, it felt just right. I felt good enough to do a record, and I'd been away from it. I thought, well, maybe absence makes the heart grow fonder.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure.
But it was mainly my decision to get a producer to help me work on it, and it was really the idea of who I could get to work with. I racked my brains because I don't really know a lot of producers. I'm sure I could put an ad in the paper. But it came to me, I thought, Jeff Lynne, if I could figure him out, if I could meet him and see if we got on well. I know musically we could get on good because of the style of his music, and he's a guitar player, songwriter, producer. So through Dave Edmonds, I got to meet, you know, ask Dave to call, or the next time he spoke to Jeff Lynne, tell him I'd like to meet him. And that happened, 18 months ago now. And so then we started just every so often just hanging out a bit, and over a period of time I got him to the point of saying, well, how's about, do you want to help me make an album? And that really worked out well. I think that's why the record is what I was saying earlier about getting bogged down on your own. You need inspiration and you need some backup from other people.
Jeff Lynne is an interesting choice. There's no reason why you should know this, but many years and years ago, I guess maybe around 1974, John Lennon did a very, very famous interview live on WNEW-FM with Dennis Elsis. He was on about 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah.
Just dropped by the station. He was living in New York. And Dennis asked him an interesting question. He said, what kind of music do you think the Beatles might be making if they were still making records? We're now talking 74, 75.
Yeah.
And he said, I think probably what ELO is doing, what Jeff Lynne is doing with ELO, would be pretty much the direction that we might have gone in had we still been making records together. And then played, it's going to be a showdown, that song, bum, 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 from Jeff Lynne and ELO.
We're going to play Electric Light Orchestra from last year, Showdown, which I thought was a great record, and I was expecting it to be number one, but I don't think UA got their fingers out and pushed it. And it's a nice group. I call them Son of Beatles, although they're doing things that we never did, obviously. But I remember the statement they made when they first formed was to carry on from where the Beatles left off with Walrus, and they certainly did. Now, for those people who like to know where licks and things come from, which I do, because I'm always nicking little things myself, this is a beautiful combination of I Heard It Through the Grapevine by Marvin Gaye and Lightning Strikes Again, Lou Christie. And it's a beautiful job with a little walrus underneath.
Well, the people, when they hear Cloud Nine, George Harrison's newest album, might get a little idea of what we're talking about when they hear a song called When We Were Fab.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
I assume that's a lot of Jeff's production.
Well, that song, I started writing that song while I was with Jeff. We happened to be in Australia, and I just had the thought, I'd like to write a new song that's like reminiscent of that period, 67. I just heard him in my head. I could hear Ringo counting it in. 1, 2, dun 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 dun. And I just started right there. Started writing that song, and then Jeff was around, and we just got on this piano, and he came up with all these little bits, like the little catchy little piano part that plays that melody on the chorus. And of course, the style of the song and the original intention was that we should have that kind of sound.
And that's why the walrus type.
Well, it's reminiscent of many different things, and we've got the sort of crazy little backing voices and little touches of phasing on some backing voices and little backwards bits and, you know, just all those little goodies. I think it worked out well, that track.
I think so, too. And when the song came on and I saw what the title would be, I assumed, well, this is going to be a song about when we were the Beatles, but it's not. The lyrics really are
They're open.
They're open for anybody who wants to.
You know how I see it is that thing, fab, first of all, is a joke word.
Yes.
I mean, it's such a tongue-in-cheek sort of thing. But that period, I think everybody was fab. You know, it wasn't just the Beatles. I mean, we were tagged
fab
with,
time.
Yeah, we were tagged with the Fab Four, but everybody was fab, weren't they? And I wrote it really for, like, that meaning everybody.
Do you have a lot of, when you put a record out like that, after all, like we said, it's your first record in 5 years. You spend a lot of time, a lot of energy. Your friends spent a lot of energy.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a lot of, that? What I'm trying to get at is the expectation, are people going to like it? Will people buy it? Will it be a top 10 album and stuff like that?
I'm not going to worry myself sick about, you know, if it does really well or not. I'm trying to promote it. You know, I'm trying to make people aware that it's out, and I'm sure you'll see me in some magazines and on the TV talking about it. But I won't say that I don't care if it's not a hit, because I do. After all that work, I would like it to, you know, do really good. And I think it's a great album. I think it's, there's place for it in the charts.
Mm-hmm.
I think the people should like it. That's the main thing. They won't buy it if it's no good, and I think it's good.
But it's not going to be like shattering if it, some reason or other. Because there are good things that some people sometimes don't find. Did you know?
No. Well,
Ry Cooder never had a top five album.
Absolutely, yeah. So many people. Well, I've not sold records before, you know. I mean, not great quantities, so I'm used to that.
This is Dave Herman here on WNEW-FM, and now back to our exclusive conversation with George Harrison.
Will there be any kind of touring with this show? I mean, you haven't been... If you were on television, you would have seen George Harrison cringe at the word touring.
Well, it's a thing that I don't understand why, you know, everybody asks this question. You know, it's automatically like as if you make a record, then you're supposed to go on tour. But I won't say that I would never, ever tour again. I think I would like to do some shows in the different periods of time, and where and when remains to be seen. But I did that concert.
The
first thing I've done in England since 1965.
We all saw it on the telly here.
It made me nervous. It was terrible. I mean, I liked the show, and I liked the tape, you know, the record of it better than the sound.
Did you not have a good time?
I did. It was good, but it was a bit like going to the electric chair, waiting to go on. You know, I mean, after a long time, you just forget how to stand up in front of an audience. You get used to it within, you know, by the middle bit, sort of into it. But, you know, your mouth dries up, and especially with the Prince's Trust, because there was only two shows. The first show, they had an electrical problem, and they didn't record anything. So it was only the one show. It was like, take one, and that was going to be a video and TV show and a record and tapes. And that's pretty hard, you know, just to expect to do a brilliant performance in one take, having not performed for 40 years.
People, not quite. People enjoyed it a lot, especially the choice of material to see you do While My Guitar Gently Weeps with Eric there.
Eric who asked me to be on the show. He said, would you do this show? They've asked me to ask you. I mean, they're pretty clever, really, because... I suppose there's more chance of me saying yes to Eric than to some guy who I don't know. So I thought, my first thought to him was, what would I do? You know, I'm just so out of touch. And he says, do Here Comes the Sun, you know. I mean, I always think that stuff's so passé.
Oh, no, these are standards.
And so to hear him request that, I think, well, it must be all right. But as I say, when it come down to the concert with an audience and TV cameras and all the press and stuff, it's very nerve-wracking because I'm alongside as Phil Collins, Eric Clapton, Elton John, and people who are touring and in the charts constantly, and makes it quite tough.
I was talking about Eric, and I don't know quite to ask you this. It's a really kind of a personal question, but it's a story that always intrigues people because most people...
Because of our marriage.
Yeah, the whole thing seems... If I could just explain to the few people who might not know that you and Eric have been best friends for many, many years.
Yeah.
And Eric wound up marrying your ex-wife, and you were best man at that wedding, and all remained friendly. Like, so most people go, these people are extraordinary. I mean,
well, they did get married years later. At first, Eric thought, you know, he went a bit strange just momentarily. He thought that we ought to have a fight or something, but it wasn't like that. And yeah, we're still the best of friends, and actually better than ever now. I think all these guys we're just talking about, as they get older, they just become so much better. And we just have a great time together, you know, with Ringo and Elton too. Elton is very funny. I mean, Eric and Elton and Jeff and I were going to cricket. You know, it's a sport in England which they perverted in America and called it baseball. Yeah. But we go to this cricket matches and just have such a laugh.
My observation over the years, and I've known a bunch of people who make records and make music, that you guys from England are much funnier than our American rock and rollers. People here, they're all very serious.
Very serious.
But you guys are always a lot of laughs.
You've got to have a sense of humor. And also, you know, where we came from, the whole city thinks the comedians, you know, Liverpool. But it's true, there is a built-in sense of humor, and I think when you take yourself too serious, like, of course, Elton goes on there, and, you know, he sings his songs seriously and all that, but, you know, he realizes what a lark it is. You know, he's a sort of little tubby fella singing these songs. You know, I mean, he's not under any great illusions. Mm-hmm. But I think with us having all been through the same experience, then, you know, it's easier for us to joke around with each other.
Do you ever listen to any of these newly issued Beatle compact discs? Have you ever heard?
Well, being a yuppie, I waited till the Beatles came out before I bought my CD player. And I listened to them, and I know there was a great controversy over them. I read many articles on it when they came out around April, I think it was, end of April, in Billboard magazine. But what George Martin was trying to say was true, that the first batch of albums were only ever made in mono. The fact that somebody once had taken the tape and made it stereo by just putting voices on one side and the backing on the other side, but they were made like that. We'd put the backing down and then sang them and they were mono. So
the point I was trying to get at was does it surprise you? It doesn't surprise anybody else, but does it surprise you how well this music holds up, how fresh and
It surprises me from the point of view that the equipment we were using in those days, like Sgt. Pepper, as many people know, was four track. I think the White Album and our last album, Abbey Road, were only eight-track tapes, because when I did All Things Must Pass, which is after Beatles finished, it was still done on an eight-track machine, and then I took some of the tracks and put them onto 16. So the quality, it's amazing that the quality is as good as it is, because most of the things we did, we had to play like all together on one track and balance stuff together, and then all together on the next track to do the overdubs and then the vocals. And as to say a remix, if you try to remix Sgt. Pepper, really all you've got is four tracks.
Mm. I was thinking even more the material itself and the way you guys are playing.
Well, I'm not surprised by the songs, because I think a lot of the songs were really very, very good songs, just really good melodies, or they had some real touches of brilliance to them. Not all of them. There's quite a few songs which I still think were just average. But it is a surprise that, you know, that to see it, when you actually see Sgt. Pepper was top in England in the album charts.
Can I, like, throw a couple of titles out at you? I'm going to take you way back here. This is something I would love to do, and I don't know whether it'll be kind of like, you know, that game Association. Somebody says a word, and the first thing comes into your mind. A Rolling Stone magazine actually did this with John, and they just threw titles at it. Did you read that? And I thought it was fascinating. So I kind of made some of your tunes.
Yeah, we are able to make mistakes, too, in our recollections.
Yeah, of course, you know, but I just wondered if anything, like where, anything, you know. Mm. Well, let's start with one that some people know the story of, and that was the Origination of Savoy Truffle, which you wrote.
Yeah,
and you write about it in the I Mean Mine book, which is a very funny story.
Well, that was the the fact that at that time, I don't know, Eric Clapton, who I was friendly with back in, it was about 1967, something like that, he seemed to keep going to the dentist having his teeth done, but he couldn't resist chocolates. And he was at my house, and there was this big box of chocolates called Good News.
Good News chocolate.
Cadbury's Good News. And he was eating these things, and so after he left, I just noticed that the names of the chocolates, you know, they have little pictures of, and names underneath them, and it was called Cream Tangerine, which I thought was funny, you know, Eric was in the cream at the time.
Oh.
So I just started making the song up from that, Cream Tangerine, Montelimar. A Ginger Sling was one, and that was funny because the, you know, Ginger Baker.
How about we'll just go or skip around.
But it says you know you're gonna have them all pulled out after the Savoy truffle.
Mini Eric's teeth.
Yes.
we'll just go or skip around.
But it says you know you're gonna have them all pulled out after the Savoy truffle.
Mini Eric's teeth.
Yes.
Great. How about from Yellow Submarine? Only a Northern Song. Does that take you back?
I think. I mean, that question, in a very strange way, relates to this Michael Jackson now owning the publishing of a lot of Beatles songs, because when we were younger, we were told, you know, well, you've got to have your, when you make a record, you have to have your song published, which, to my mind, that was, it sort of gets it, like, copyrighted so that nobody steals it, or so that you get paid if it sells any. And there was this guy, Dick James, who came along and with a form, and for us to fill in form. And for the publishing, you know, it said how much he was going to get for the service of it and how much he would get. Now, I signed these things because they told me that's what you did. But what they failed to say was, I'm actually stealing your song. When you sign this thing, you're signing the copyright to me. It's like the Ruttles, I'm sure you saw the Ruttles, you know, Dick Jaws, an out-of-work music publisher of no fixed ability, signed them up for the rest of their lives. Lucky, really. So, I think I was feeling a bit...
ripped off?
Yeah. And so, that song, because it was Northern Songs, the company. So, that song was just a joke on that, really, you know.
Well, on that subject, did
it doesn't matter if, it doesn't really matter what clothes I wear, or how I fare, or if my hair is brown, because it's only a Northern song.
You actually remember the lyrics, right? So your recollection is terrific. Well, on that subject, I'll digress, because I had another note here. At least twice a month, people will read in the papers or hear on the radio that the Beatles are suing, and they say it that way. The Beatles are suing Nike shoes. Just now realized. Do you know that the Beatles are suing Dave Clark? Are you aware of that?
Oh, good.
Do you? You don't.
Well,
see,
tell
my
you,
question was who are the
Beatles? Who is Dave Clark?
No, who are? My question is,
who are the Beatles?
Who are, when they say that, I mean, do people come around to knock on your door and say, George, we want to sue Dave Clark?
Have, and always have had a company called Apple. Long before there was computers, we had this company called Apple. As everybody knows, Apple Records, Apple Films, Apple this, that, and the other. We made movies, we had film clips, we had records, we had all these things. And that company, the four of us were directors of that company at the time. Now we've assigned the directorship to our personal managers or representatives, because there's still so much that goes on in that business. We have our guy called Neil Aspinall, who's been with us, Paul and I, he was with since school, and he's there running Apple. And what it is just like any other company who owns something. You know, it's their property, and other people come along and try to use that, either by getting permission to use it, licensing, or by stealing it, by thinking, you know, well, these guys, because they've read so much about the fact that, you know, we went through turbulent years, and there's a lot of stuff like that now. There's people putting out videos, which actually they don't own, but which I presume is the Dave Clark selling videos of our performances. There's things like the Beatlemania program, which was on Broadway and everywhere. Well, we have to you know, there became like a free-for-all where people would just go out and think the Beatles were like public domain, like Mozart or something. Oh, well, there are these old people, and it's so familiar to us all. Let's use that. I've got a great idea. Let's get another 30 Beatles songs, make up characters based upon the characters in the songs, and we'll come up with a flimsy idea and make a 90-minute movie. You know, I mean, this is a new idea that somebody wants to make called Strawberry Fields. It's not really about Strawberry Fields. It's about all the Beatles songs. It's about how to make a project and sell it based upon the Beatles rather than based upon their own talent. And that's what's been happening to us. We had to stop these things in order to set the precedent that you can't just come along and rip us off. So with Beatlemania, we had to sue them. We actually, the funny thing about that is we were going to settle with them out of court for $1 million, and they refused, or they had an insurance company that refused to pay the million. So it went to court. The judge awarded us $11 million. So, you know, we settled then with them for some figure beneath that. But really, it's to say, now, look, you can't just go around pilfering the Beatles' material. And with the Nike thing, in a way, it's not entirely Nike's fault, because they asked for the song. They were going to do probably one of those sound-alike things, which is legitimate if they get the rights from
the publisher.
The publisher. Publisher, as we just talked about, is no longer us. It got taken away from us, and it's been sold and sold off, and now it's apparently owned by CBS or by Michael Jackson.
Unless somebody bought it this morning.
Yeah. And so that's all pretty legitimate. Like, I've requests all the time, can we use Here Comes the Sun for an advert for ladies' knickers, you know. If I want, I can say, yes, you can, but they have to make up their own version of that tune, and we have to license them. But with Nike, they were going to do this other version, and apparently Yoko said, I want the John Lennon singing it, the Beatle version. And that's what's really thrown the cat among the pigeons, because in a way it's the conflict of interest. Apple and its directors are trying to look after, safeguard our past and our present by having proper licensing and all this. The other point to be made, people should understand, is that when we were actively the Beatles in the 60s, we were asked to do Coca-Cola commercials and Pepsi-Cola commercials and advertise this and advertise that, and people wanted to give us, relative to that period of time, plenty of money to do that. And now we made a decision, the four of us, that we don't want to do that. We don't want to sell out. We want to retain some dignity, and that's what we did. And I think that is a lot to do also with what you're saying. Are you surprised about how the Beatles keep on going? The Beatles had integrity. We tried with our songs, we tried our recordings to make them as nicely as we could for that period of each period of time. We tried to put a good running order, good material, good sleeves, everything like that. When it got out there in the world, it's when it all turns into, you know, different kinds of albums in America. But basically, we didn't want to take money for advertising. Now, as the Beatles have been 20 years or so, people seem to think that now we can use the Beatles to advertise.
This is WNEW-FM in New York. I'm Dave Herman, and now let's continue with our exclusive conversation with George Harrison.
People assume that since your kind of disappearance from the public eye following John's death so closely, that you kind of withdrew, and that it was a very, you know, that the personal loss for you was really quite traumatic and profound, and that that had something to do with the fact that you haven't been all that visible.
Well, it's not all that true, because I have been, before his death, I had been laying low, keeping a low profile, purely in order just to try and have some sort of life. Because you can't do it all the time, every day, being on TV and being in magazines and stuff, and then people start taking you for granted. And And that period I lay low, and it was quite funny, really, because the press in England kept saying I was like Howard Hughes, I never left the house and all this. But really, I went out all the time. I'd visit friends, go out to dinner, go to the movies. I just didn't hang out in places where the gossip columnists go. But at the same time, when that happened with John, it wasn't exactly a nice thing to think about. It made, I think, not just us, it makes everybody realize how vulnerable you are. As I recall reading in a book, somebody once said, life is fragile like a raindrop on a lotus leaf, and it can just drop at any moment. And so, also, as you know, because we spent time together at the motor racing, you know, that driver in the 70s and 80s called Niki Lauda, what happened to him where he nearly died, and he wrote a book saying he made him realize when he got his life back that just by not thinking, you know, you can just fall down the stairs and kill yourself, you know, things like that happen, and you really have to just give a bit of thought day by day to, you know, not being silly. And you know, life, we never know when our life's taken away from us, and so John's death certainly influenced all of us, but it wasn't that reason why I was going laying low.
How did you receive that news?
I was asleep at the time, because as you know, England's 5 hours ahead of New York, and Neil Aspinall, who we just talked about from Apple, he phoned up about, must have been about 3 or 4 in the morning or something like that, and said that he'd been shot. But at that point, you know, I was, the first thing I thought of was, God, you know, how bizarre, but, you know, is he okay? I thought, it was just a flesh wound or something, but it was very bizarre.
Let's get back to that. I'm going to throw out some more of these songs. We kind of digressed, and I'm just going to pick a couple more. Some of my favorites, like On Rubber Soul, If I Needed Someone.
That song, I tell you about that song. It was just purely based upon the Rickenbacker 12-string sound. And I think as the Birds were influenced by the Beatles, so we were influenced by the Birds, you know, and they had that album out with Tambourine Man. And that's what I wrote that from an idea of doing that kind of thing.
Well, what I remember about Rubber Soul, being just a Beatle fan back at the time, was that, you know, each of the four of you had your fans. You know, there were the John DePaul fans,
yeah.
He was the cute one, and then there was the George fans, he was the silent one, little did they know.
Yeah.
But the thing about that was, oh, George has got two songs.
Wow, big deal. Yeah.
George has got two songs on Rubber Soul.
Yeah.
Now, is that was always a sore point amongst them?
It wasn't a sore point. It was just difficult because, obviously, they started writing first. Mm-hmm. And after I think my first tune was on the our second album, which was actually the first one released in the States. So, I mean, I was a year behind, or maybe 2 years behind in writing. But when they were writing these tunes, I thought, well, if they can do it, so can I. But they had each other to bounce off of, which gets back to this album, see, with Jeff Lynne. It's the first time I felt like being in a group, although there's just the two of us, basically, and the other guys would come and play for us. But in writing and producing and arranging, it's like being in a band. So, I mean, you know, I got a couple of tunes in there, and that's why All Things Must Pass, as I've said before. It was like being constipated, and then suddenly you're allowed to go.
How come it was it's either Lennon McCartney or it's George Harrison? There was never an occasion where, you know, George and Paul could write a song?
Well, they decided long before, they decided we'll write together, and whatever we write alone, it'll still be Lennon McCartney. Now, anybody who's really into Beatle music can listen, and they'll tell you which is Paul's songs and which is John's, or which were collaborations, or which were, say, Paul's. But then there's a lot of stuff they don't know, because, I mean, I was involved with bits and pieces in various songs, and as was Ringo, in as much as arrangements, but or even down to lyrics and things like that. But because their contract said they'd be Lennon McCartney forever, then that's the way it was.
And one last question about these songs. How did it come to pass that Eric was in the studio for While My Guitar Gently Weeps to put down that lead guitar line on that song of yours.
Because I'd been with him that morning before I went in the studio, and he was going into London. I'd had a difficult time the day before we started to record that song, but there was a bit of a lack of interest from the Lennon-McCartney songwriting duo. I mean, there was a bit of needle in as much as, you know, they were writing and they didn't really, not so much John, but Paul at the time, he was a bit bitchy, and he, you know, you had to do like 29 of his tunes before he'd consider doing mine. So Guitar Gently Weeps, I happened to like, I thought it was a decent tune, and we were trying to learn the tune, routine it, and record it. And there was not much joy, you know, and I went on that night thinking, you know, that's not it, got to do it better than that. And Eric was with me, and I said, why don't you come and play on this record? And a similar thing happened when Billy Preston walked in. At the time, we did Let It Be. Suddenly, they all go on their best behavior.
Well, you mentioned that you thought, My Guitar Gently Weeps is a pretty good tune. When the CD of the White Album came out just a couple of months ago, when we had just arrived.
Yeah,
at the
I still
station,
haven't heard that myself.
Well, you see, that to me is my favorite. It's my favorite on CD. You know why, George? Because I never realized Ringo is all over that record, and you can really hear the vinyl album that we've always had was a rather mellow record for the most part, you know, the whole gestalt of it.
Yeah.
But when you hear it on CD, it's really a rockin' album.
Yeah, I look forward to hearing that one. It hadn't come out in England at the time I left England back in
Ringo's contribution to all that work on
his
that
contribution to everything. I mean, even down to things like, I mean, Ringo, I mean, things he would say which became lyrics or song titles, you know, like Hard Day's Night, for instance, was just him, the slip of the tongue, and that's how he came
Rain.
Out. He did, I mean, so many things. I mean, maybe he wasn't a brilliant songwriter, but he was certainly an equal contributed in the band.
Well, at any rate, when we got this the White Album in on CD, I was on the air at the time live, and the guy from EMI brought the CD in. So I said, tell you what we do, we got all this music now on CD by the White Album. We'll open up the phones, we'll take 50 calls, we'll play three songs off the album. What are your three favorite songs on the White Album? And the three, do you think you could guess them? What do you want me to tell you? Well, While My Guitar Gently Weeps was second. The most popular song on the album, and 50 Calls, a pretty good sampling.
But back in the U.S.,
no, it was Rocky Raccoon.
Oh.
Was people's favorite.
Really?
And Dear Prudence was third, and While My Guitar Gently Weeps was the second most favorite.
I liked that. Like Prudence.
Yes, nice song. So I guess it was a pretty good tune, because it's a long time ago, and people still want to hear it all the time.
That's nice. Actually, it's in the movie. We've just done a movie that's out in the States. Plug, plug, plug. Handmade films called Whitsnail.
Yes.
And I...
It's playing in New York right now.
And it's about the end of the 60s, and that tune is being played, you know, in one sequence, as is some Jimi Hendrix tracks and stuff.
I'll help with the plug, because I haven't seen it, but the critics are raving about it.
It's a very funny film.
Yeah. Very. But let's talk about George the filmmaker, you want to talk about Sean Penn and Madonna and working with them?
I don't mind.
Because George Harrison and Madonna, just from you know, media images of people, struck people funny.
Strange, very strange. I agree, too. I mean, it was the sort of thing... First of all, the movie had been in handmade films for some time. We'd considered making it. And I must say that most people in handmade films didn't really want to make that movie. And then there was some talk about that Madonna may be in the lead part, because the film's producer happened to know Sean or something like this. Now, that film got one day away from it being elbowed out, and then we had this phone call saying that Madonna really wants to be in it, and she told Sean that if you know, want to see me for the next few months, then, you know, why don't you be in it too? So suddenly it was on. It seemed like a good idea at the time. So, but we were one day away from not doing it. Now, I must say that the press were a bit unkind to them. You know, I've experienced this thing with the Beatles, that they love you and they build you up to a point where
the only thing left is to try and knock you down. So there was a lot of that attitude, and some of the stuff they wrote in the British press was just terrible. It was just really nasty. And I think it was a bit over the top.
Well, Sean doesn't help.
But at the same time, their attitudes didn't help. Like, you know, most older people remember the Beatle press conferences that we did when we came to America. Now, as you said earlier, we have a sense of humor. And that's one thing that she didn't seem to have. Which was a bit of a pity, because it was a comedy movie. But anyway, nevertheless, they were treated unfairly, really. It was all this getting in the way of them making the film, because, you know, Sean would come in and read the papers, and he'd go crazy. He'd hit the wall, and then he'd take it out on all the film crew, and then they'd
didn't
go...
Didn't get you, did he?
Oh, no. The film crew were getting to the point where they just didn't like the pair of them. And what I did was a sort of Henry Kissinger job, just to try and get it finished. And I said to Sean, you know, if they're going to write all this about you, you just can't read it. Just don't read it. Or if you do read it, don't let it affect you. But it's impossible. I must say, Sean, when he's not going crazy, is absolutely brilliant. I mean, the scenes when he is up, he's a good actor. But, you know, when he's down, it shows. And he's got a good sense of humor, he has, and he's a real funny fella. I had some good times with him.
Which is the crazier business, the movie business or the rock and roll record business? Or are they equally insane?
Definitely the movie business.
Weirder.
Well, there's a lot more at stake, more money, you know, I mean, even a cheap film, because we tend to make low-budget films. But it's still, you're talking about, you know, anywhere between $2 and $8 million. And there's all these other people involved, you know, there's all hundreds of people in the crews and the directors and assistant directors and producers and actors and stuff. And with a film, it takes so much longer to actually get to see what it is. And also, you know, with a record making music, you can write a tune and you can record it and hear instantly, more or less, what it's like. And you can take away or add to it. Relatively simple, whereas a film takes on its own life, and although you can edit later and do various things to it, but basically it's a much longer process and much more costly, and so therefore the stakes are higher and the, you know, aggravation is a bit higher too.
Wasn't there a documentary feature about the Beatles in the works for...
Yeah.
I saw some footage actually at your house.
That's right. Well, that's still waiting to come out, but...
I mean, the complete Beatles, that was called
the Convention. Again, that was one of those things which we have had all this footage for a long time and been trying to get it out, and it's gone, you know, dormant for a while, and then it's come back again, but... the only problem at the moment is that Yoko wants to make her version of the Beatles story, and so she won't, being, you know, John's heir to the Apple stuff, she won't agree to that, because she wants her version of it, where the Beatles probably didn't have much to do with anything.
And one last question that I was personally curious about, because you have a family now, a little boy.
Mm.
Does he have any idea of course he knows your daddy.
Yeah.
But does he know that daddy means something to other people?
Oh, yeah,
too?
He does now.
How old is he?
He's 9. So I think what happens, I didn't tell him anything about the Beatles, you know, so he only just found out, you know, by getting to the age, I think like most 5 and 6 year olds watch Yellow Submarine. And, because I was surprised one day when he was started showing an interest in the piano, and he said, "Hey, Dad, show me the Hey Bulldog piano part." You know, dun 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 da dun da dun dun. I said, "How do you know Bulldog?" Because it's, to my mind, it's an obscure song. I keep forgetting that it's been in this Yellow Submarine for years. And he said, "Oh yeah, from the Yellow Submarine." So, as he's got older, he's become more and more aware of the Beatles actually, you know, I mean, it's hard not to, because there's always something happening on TV or, you know, documentaries or whatever.
Okay, anything you want to tell the folks in New York? Maybe you'll see them on stage sometime.
Yeah.
You know, don't cringe.
Oh, yeah, I know, maybe. Maybe. There's, I hear, you see, Eric, last time I talked to him, he was saying, Elton's forming a band for over 40-year-olds. And then he laughed, and with... So he said, I said, oh, who's in it? He said, you're in it. So apparently I'm in it. So it remains to be seen.
Thanks, George.
But in the meantime, just hello, New York, and I hope you like the record.
Our conversation with George Harrison was an exclusive presentation of WNEW-FM Radio, produced by our production director, Tom Couch. I wish to personally thank Kenny Pogogel and Valerie Goodman at Warner Brothers, and of course, a very, very special thank you to George Harrison. I'm Dave Herman on WNEW-FM in New York.
And I want to thank Dave Herman. Was that great? 90 minutes with George Harrison and Dave, and I learned all kinds of things about George and the Beatles that I had never even dreamed of, quite frankly. That was wonderful. 26 minutes before 2, this is Dennis Elsis, WNEW-FM in New York.